We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
A Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, to monsters and the monstrous when they produce works of art we love. Welcome to Potterversity. On today's episode, we're talking with author and podcaster Lori Kim about how we relate to monsters and the monstrous, especially when they produce works of art we love. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competence at Mount Carmel College, and co-author of several edited volumes, including Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
Just a fair warning to our listeners today, we are going to be talking about difficult subjects on this episode. And if any of this is triggering for you, we hope that you will take care of yourself, pause or skip ahead where needed. We are going to have, I hope, an honest and I think pretty interesting conversation today. With this challenging topic, Emily, I think it's really important for us to talk about it because it's central to the Harry Potter series and the fandom, and that is this question of monsters and the monstrous. Of course, there are lots of monsters in the wizarding world.
Yes.
Dementors and...
Right, even monstrous books.
Blasted and Scroots. Right.
Yeah, right.
The Monster Book of Monsters. Absolutely. The Fantastic Beasts series is centered on an examination of monsters, human and otherwise. But people have also charged the series author J.K. Rowling with herself being monstrous, particularly after tweets and then the essay that she posted in the spring and early summer of 2020. Before we delve into the fraught topic immediately relevant to our podcast, Emily, let me ask you, have you encountered other artists whose work you've struggled to appreciate after knowing part of their biography that was troubling to you?
Yes. You know, like many people, I'm definitely a lifelong Michael Jackson fan. First album I ever bought, it was actually an LP. So that's been hard. And then, many of our listeners know I am a Catholic church musician, and we have had several composers in our tradition whose works have either been pulled from hymnals or and become unpublished and therefore unusable. And because of, accusations against them, credible accusations and
accusations against the composers.
Yeah. So this really is an issue that I wrestle with a lot in a lot of different areas of my life. What about you?
Yeah, I struggle with Michael Jackson on the radio.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm bopping along with Michael Jackson, but then sometimes I'm like, I think I'm going to skip this one. Mm-hmm. And I'll just flip to a different channel.
I'm powerless to flip, but it does fill my mind a lot of times. And I find myself thinking as I'm kind of, singing along or whatever, that like I'm thinking about him and his process and
right.
the different. Yeah. So it's not, even if I don't flip it off, it doesn't mean it's far from my mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I will say also that Picasso, I do look at Picasso pretty differently. Once I was adult enough to know some of what he did to the various women in his life. And I find him challenging to enjoy, especially because a lot of his art does deal with women. And I feel like it does have an impact on the art, you know?
Yeah.
Not like it's somehow separate from what he was, the way he was treating the women in his life. It doesn't seem to me that way anyway.
Right, right. Yeah, it's definitely caused me to, I used to be a big death of the author person, and it's definitely caused me to kind of say, that's not always possible to separate the art from the artist. But that's something I hope we talk more about today.
Right. Yeah, we're going to be talking about that. And I think you and I, Emily, have talked about this before, because as a historian, historians don't talk about texts doing things on their own. It's just not how we talk, right? People do things. People do things, right? The whole point is human agency. Sometimes you have systems that do things.
I guess, I mean, the Monster Book of Monsters does do things on its own. But,
well, that's,
you know.
Oh, there. Okay, you got me. You got me there, Emily.
Some of those books in the restricted section are definitely doing things on their own.
They have some individual agency. Yes, I would agree with that. Yes. And so I'm just saying, from my professional disciplinary perspective, it's just hard for me to get in the idea of death of the author. And I think this conversation is going to help us to kind of understand this question of how you deal with the art in relation to the artist and troubling biographies. And helping us have this conversation, Emily and I are very delighted to welcome to the show author and podcaster Lori Kim. Lori is a columnist for MuggleNet who writes pop culture and literary criticism, often with, as she says, quote, a focus on intersectional feminism, LGBTQ+ rights, and inclusive literature, end quote. In addition to numerous conference presentations, Lori is the author of the book Snape, A Definitive Analysis, a wonderful close study of a complex, perhaps monstrous, character, which is now in an updated edition that I cannot recommend highly enough. If you have not read Snape, A Definitive Analysis, you've got to read this book. Lori also hosts a podcast called Harry Potter After 2020, a rereading of the book series after Rowling's anti-trans statements. And Lori has honestly done a lot of other writing as well, and we are so excited to have you on the show. Lori, welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. This topic is something that I think has been, in a sense, the only subject of Harry Potter fandom discourse since 2020. It isn't, but it is. And I think everybody needs to grapple with it. And we've sort of been wanting to be told to tell each other and to be told, what are we supposed to do about this now?
Right. I think it's such a big question. And, you know, Emily and I have just read this book that we know you also have read, Claire Dederer's Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma, where she talks about exactly this topic. And what I really like, she's a former film critic who loves Roman Polanski films and wonders if she's still allowed to love them, given what we know about Polanski's very troubling history. And what I appreciate about Dederer's approach is that she does not go in with, like you say, we're like looking for somebody to tell us, you have to do this, or this is what you're allowed to do. And she doesn't go in thinking that she has the answer. And in fact, when you're reading the book, you're reading her quite funny, like mental process as she tries to get around this question about the many, many artists who have courted the label monstrous for a variety of reasons. And like, are we allowed to still ingest, appreciate, consume, think about their art? And do we have to think about their biography as we're thinking about their art? So I'm very excited to get into this conversation. To start us off, Lori, I think you're the perfect person to talk with us today about this, because I see in your work a real fascination with, I think, kind of ambiguously good or evil characters, including Snape. What interests you about monsters and the monstrous, and why do you think it's a good subject for us to talk about?
Well, certainly the Harry Potter series has tons of monsters in it, Voldemort being the biggest one. And the whole concept of monstrosity is if there's something in yourself that you can't handle, that you can't think about, that's something that you reject violently and you project it onto an other, and then you're hostile against the other, then you've made the other into a monster. At the same time, when we're afraid of other people who are monsters, and I deal with human monsters. I know there are hybrid other animals that are monsters also, but to me, it's all a reflection of how humans see ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
One kind of monster that is really frightening is somebody that was once like us, somebody that we thought was like us, and then it turns out that they're not, and they can hurt people. They can hurt us. Is it that they know that they are hurting other people and they just don't care? Or is it that they've changed somehow? And if they've changed, could that happen to us too?
Mm. Yeah, I just thought of Gollum from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Smeagol.
And, you know, Harry is constantly afraid. Voldemort put a part of himself in me. Am I always going to be myself, or will I turn into him without even knowing it? Or, you know, when the children find out that the Dumbledore they knew, who was a potent force for good, was once monstrous, what does that mean about themselves and their trust in him? You know, can they even trust their own perceptions? Were they really like him?
Yeah, I love that idea that you're, it's something that you fear within yourself, that you're rejecting as you see it in someone else and you call it monstrous, but that your real fear is that that's you. And, you know, I was thinking about you think about Harry and how similar his biography is to Voldemort or Tom Riddle's, that he's always connecting those similarities and thinking, like maybe this is me too. And then, of course, what is it that makes them worried about Dumbledore? It's revelations about his biography, right? About his past. And Claire Dederer talks about this too, that we're in a biography saturated media realm, and we just know a lot about people. And as we know about a lot of the skeletons in their closet and everything, you know, we know a lot about what's going on with them. This, you know, it raises these questions about the very serious flaws that so many human beings do have.
I've oscillated between having some problems with the whole death of the author approach to absolutely flat out hating it and disagreeing violently with it.
Emily,
roll the
take
violence.
That.
Roll the violence. No, I love it. I mean, you know, because it's not supposed to be just one way. So I'm interested in hearing your perspective.
And I understand that when Roland Barthes was first proposing it, it was in reaction against a stultifying attitude that nothing matters but the authority of the author. And I understand that it had to make a strong statement. However, I don't think that it's possible to have art without the artist, because especially if we're talking about writing, the author chooses every word. It comes from the author's flaws and or their humanity, which are the same thing. You can mm-hmm. read any book you want. Why did you choose this one? Because something in its flaws and humanity spoke to your own. Why do we even read books instead of just making up our own stories? Because there's an author who's telling us a story. We want to hear them tell it to us their way. Why does it matter whether the same author has written the sequel or some other has? We want to hear what this person, with their flaws and their humanity, have to say to us about ours.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just write our own fan fiction? We can do any fan fiction we want. Well, we can. Why do we have favorite fan fiction authors then? If there's just a story without human flaw as the artist telling it, then it's not art. It's just fact.
Well, and I think too, Lori, about all this AI writing that we're increasingly saturated with, which my brother calls zombie writing. I'm sure there are other people who call it that too. It's like the Walking Dead. And it's because there's not a person behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. in a way, like that makes me think of what you're saying there, that that what we're getting in a book is a subjective perspective. I love this idea of it's their humanity and flaws speaking to ours in a way that is resonant and meaningful. It's deeply humanistic. And, you know, if we try to detach it somehow, then we've really lost what the whole point was.
Yeah, I definitely responded to J.K. Rowling as a person, because the things that she values in her story, the things that she proposes as important for readers, that's inevitably what accounted for this story above any other, becoming an international, globally shared story, which is almost impossible to do. But if she was going to locate the commonality of human feelings in the need for newborn infants for love, for example, or what happens to human souls when we hurt others and feel guilt, and what choices we have about reintegrating ourselves after that or not. She, to find something that's cross-culturally universal enough to be a global phenomenon like that, that was an achievement, and that was filtered through her humanity, including her flaws. And we can say as much as we want, oh, the story doesn't belong to an author anymore. The story belongs to everybody else. I think that's an academic exercise that doesn't pan out for me.
I think one thing that attracts me about Death of the Author as a theory is the way that it suggests, as I understand it, the art has some kind of independence. And it, not that I think I'm now convinced that it can never be fully independent from the artist, but that whether we intend to, as artists, whether we intend to or not, we end up creating something that does have some sort of life of its own, and that maybe is infused with more than just our intentions, you know, and that, you know, it takes on a life of its own. And so I think that's one thing that I kind of cling to, but I am really starting to agree. Like, for instance, I mentioned earlier, we have these problematic composers in the Catholic contemporary music tradition. And I hope this isn't too triggering for anybody, but it turns out, you know, that one of these composers was actually using the music that he composed to manipulate victims. So, you know,
he would compose
a song for someone in order to, you know, keep them close to him and things like that. And that really was kind of a gut punch to me in my love of Death of the Author theory, you know, in terms of like, okay, this is art being created monstrously. This is art being created in a way that is monstrous. And so that has kind of helped me to set some parameters in my mind for that theory, while still hanging on to this idea that I, as an artist, you know, that there's almost a mystical quality to me in creating art, that there is some kind of alchemy that happens that is not all me, you know, that it goes beyond myself. And I think that's one of those beliefs that keeps me from turning it off when a Michael Jackson song comes on, you know, that there is something about this art that belongs to all of us, and not just him, you know, and not just his biographical details and his crimes or whatever they were, you know.
But I think what Laurie is saying, that even maybe goes beyond that, is that we are all monstrous in some way. And I think Claire Dederer goes to this point as well. She thinks of herself, and at a couple of points, she says, oh, maybe I've become a monster, and maybe this is part of my monstrousness. And that if we reject the art of people who are monstrous, are we just lying to ourselves about our level of flaw? Or, I mean, you know, there are crimes, do you know what I mean? And there's abuse. And I'm not saying that we're all operating at that level, but everybody's got something, right? That,
yeah,
you know, that could potentially, if they acted upon it, or we can all make this transition to the monstrous. And I do agree with you, Laurie, that I think that's a part of what J.K. Rowling is even saying in the Harry Potter series.
Yeah, and part of what's been making this question of what Harry Potter fans do about her turn since 2020 toward making her entire brand transphobia.
Well, that and is so true. The more I've heard you say that before, Lori, and the more I think about that, the more I'm like, wow, that is really accurate, because that's exactly what people think about. At least the people I talk to, you know, right. are constantly turning to me and saying, "So you're still doing this, huh?" And how do you, what do you do, you know, how do you respond to it? And how are you, because it really is now her brand.
Well, she hasn't stopped talking mm-hmm. about it. You know, it's a political view that she has, and she thinks that she's defending a particular group who are powerless in their own way. And so I think that's what keeps her going. But she's, of course, ingesting a lot of stuff that is inaccurate and untrue and frankly unkind as well. But I think one of the things that's so tricky about that, right, the brand, is that it seems so counter to the brand that people fell in love with, because people did feel they knew J.K. Rowling's story and they felt like they knew her through her books. I think, Lori, you were kind of saying something similar along those lines. And then she comes out with this, you know, with this idea. They're like, wait, no, that's not how you're supposed to think. That's we didn't think that was how you think.
Yeah, one of my favorite insights from Dederer's book were some of these insights about fan culture and how fan culture and the desire for these biographical details of artists and the kind of parasocial relationships that form between fans and the art that they love, the artists that they love, plays a role in these very problems. So how do we articulate that? How do these fan cultures play a role in highlighting artists' biographies and consideration of the art? And is it a good thing? Is it always good? Is it always bad? Or is it, you know, where does it fall?
So the model that Claire Dederer proposes as an alternative to death of the author theory, she says, consuming a piece of art is two biographies meeting. The biography of the artist that might disrupt the viewing of the art, the biography of the audience member that might shape the viewing of the art. This occurs in every case. And that definition, that definition from her really stood out to me, because in her entire book, Monsters, she shies away powerfully from ever offering any definitive answers except there. This occurs in every case, because it's not that there's a fixed midpoint between author and audience member. It's that that point of meeting is different for every audience member. You know, are you somebody who reads Harry Potter in translation in a continent other than Europe, and you have no idea what this author has been saying on Twitter, now X, for the past 4 years? You don't even know if the author's name. Or are you somebody like the Anglophone communities that we're in, where we used to read Twitter every day before Elon Musk practically deplatformed J.K. Rowling by destroying Twitter? You know, we actually are concerned with what she says because it's closer to our biographies. We hear about it. You know, that point between art and audience member is someplace different, but that's where the meaning is. It's not more in the work of art. It's not more in the audience member. If the artist simply wrote or created art and didn't show it to anyone, that would be different. But creating the art is a piece of communication that humans, we make the art and we seek out other people's art because we feel things and we want to know if other people feel them too. Hmm. And fans in fan communities, what we're doing is we have read or watched the same piece of media and felt things. We want to find other people who did too, so we can learn more about each other and ourselves. Did you see what I saw? How did you feel about it? So mm-hmm. this is the purpose of a fan community and of art that we hold collectively, is to love each other better and to know ourselves better and possibly to feel less alone, or to understand more how much variety there is among humans that we love. That love for this particular media source material, that's essential because it made us feel. So we find people who also had a feeling about this source material enough to have thoughts about it and to want to talk to us about it.
Well, and in that sense, the artist is almost like that ultimate person who felt, you know, who you can share those feelings with, because, you know, if you're feeling that, I mean, I remember, because what Detterer says is that, you know, the rise of the internet, you know, gives us access to so much more information, and kind of modern culture gives us access to so much more information about artists and their biographies that cause these resonances and these sort of parasocial relationships where we think we know this person. We really, because we've embraced their art and it speaks to us and it causes us to feel these things. And we know that the artist must have felt them too in order to make the art, right? And so we share that. We feel that we share that bond with them. I will say that in my life, I mean, I'm one of these adults I'm in my late 40s now. And so the internet, you know, wasn't around when I was a child, and then it was around, and it was like this crazy thing, this crazy new thing that you could explore. And I remember the first thing on the internet that I really did for hours on end is to look at the website belonging to James Taylor, who is my ultimate favorite musical artist for all time since I was a child until now, and to read his very long biographical entry, which I had no access to that information about him and how he grew up and the instruments that he played and his influences and his family life and his drug habit and his marriages. And I had no idea about any of this stuff. And I remember being so moved by it and feeling so connected to him, knowing these things, that this is what the internet was to me. It was this portal for me to learn more about this person that I was a fan of. And so that really spoke to me in her book. And I do think that when we think we know this person, then when they, something that they do or say contradicts that, you know, what we thought we knew in our minds, then that can really be sort of a crisis for the fan, you know, a crisis in their enjoyment, not only of the artist, but of the art as well.
One of the problems that is specific to Harry Potter and other children's lit when we have a conflict with the author is that what we feel about media that we consumed when we were children, it's different and more vulnerable than what we feel if we were already adults and had more defenses. Because one of the creeping fears involved is, were we somehow groomed? When you make literature for children that's getting to their emotions and need for narrative, bypassing adult defenses, if you can get them to imprint on your story, are you grooming them for some nefarious, you know, ulterior motive that is to be revealed later? That's this fear that it's really hard to get away from. One of the shadow fears about this whole issue of monstrosity is pedophilia. Like, you know, is there some sort of thing that we allowed to have happen to us that, you know, that we didn't know? Because reading a piece of children's literature is an act of trust. You know, if you're a parent, you know, and you permit it, yes, okay, I'm allowing you, author or artist, access to my child's inner life. You know, as a child imbibing it, there's so many reasons for children to not trust adults. But if you find a piece of children's literature that you feel like, this person gets it, you know, then you let down your defenses, you allow yourself in. And that's why when I think about some kinds of art with problematic creators, the content matters. The closer it is to childhood, the scarier it feels. Like, this was an interesting case because it wasn't fully the creator, but Kevin Clash, who was the puppeteer who animated Elmo, the Muppet.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Who was a genius, who did some profound work for American culture and, you know, infants and toddlers really bonding with Elmo. And then it turned out he had unequal relationships with teen boys and was, you know, canceled from Sesame Street. And Elmo the character, Elmo the Muppet, who is, you know, a multi-billion-dollar empire by himself, you know, was passed on to different animators. So Did any of that creepiness enter into Elma? No, it was more, it was possible in that case to sort of make the transition without disrupting too much, but there was that uneasiness. And then on the other hand, I think the creator who creeps me out the most, that I personally just have the most trouble with, and this is all personal, as Claire Deuterer says, none of it is logical. You can try to put logic on it. Good luck. It's not going to work. It's all and only about feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And the one who creeps me out the most is Marion Zimmer Bradley.
Oh, right.
I read.
I just gave that book to my daughter, and I did think about it. She's very into Arthurian stuff. And I was like, okay, I'm going to give, like, she's 15, right? So I think she's able to see things and make her own decisions. But I did think about it as I was handing her the book.
The thing that made it harder for me was that some of the things that were crimes that I learned about were thematically present in the work.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it harder for me to know what to do with it. And on a different axis entirely, when I think about what I imbibed as a child, possibly the most problematic creator is Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, I learned about the Declaration of Independence as a child. We were deliberately taught this. I welcomed it. The words are amazing. I thought that they were for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there I was, a young child, an Asian female child. And I thought, oh, yes, I'm American. This is meant for me. And they imprinted on me. They're part of my identity. I'm not giving them up. They are meant for me now. Legally, things have been made so that technically they do apply to me. I qualify for these words. Obviously, at the time that Jefferson wrote them, they would not have applied to somebody like me. And then we find out more about who he was. Does that change what a brilliant creator of words he was? No.
Good it was to have those words out there. Right. And even though he wasn't living up to them, and he didn't even really mean them in the most broad way that they exist on the page, having them out there is something to shoot for.
And it's affected not only my identity, but also the political ideologies of countries and thinkers all over the world for a few centuries now. Art is something that's better than the artist. Otherwise, it would just be like your diary or your schedule, you know, right, your calendar online. If you're going to make art, what do we have art for if it's not going to be better than how we are as everyday people? But it does always have the flavor of the creator, and that's what makes it great. If it doesn't have that, then it's also not art.
You were talking about the importance of, especially when we think about art for children, and who I think about here is Roald Dahl, who has marvelous children's story and was a raging anti-Semite. And one of the things that I worry about in that way, you talked about grooming, and I think in a way it's this, like, are there, subtle or not, anti-Semitic poses that he takes in these novels, maybe he doesn't even realize consciously that he's doing that, that then are shaping a culture in which children who've read those novels are maybe more open to those stereotypes or those kinds of ideas. And I'm going to say full out, I have not studied Roald Dahl in a way to see that, but I actually do think that the Potter community has been looking back through the books to see, do we see some of the problematic, like, exclusionary ideas of J.K. Rowling? Are they evident in this world that she created? And now that we know this about her biography, maybe we can be more alert to it.
Well, definitely the Harry Potter series is a direct descendant of Roald Dahl. Mm-hmm. And you can see that even, I think, it's called The Egg and the Eye. It's one of my favorite chapters. It's in Goblet of Fire. And Harry is invisible and horrified and transfixed as Snape, Mad-Eye Moody, and Filch have a three-way showdown of, like, the three ugliest Brit men. And they're all just horrendous. And it's so Roald Dahl. It's so Dickens. It's monstrous. It's, you know, you teen boy, when you become a British adult man, this is your future. This is what you're looking at. And it's so petty and snarling and frightening. And that, yeah, that's a world, sort of a post-World War II English culture that Harry Potter definitely comes from. You know, and the way that Roald Dahl wrote monstrous adults, the way, you know, the Dursleys are direct descendants of that. And they're also descendants of Dickens writing monstrous looking people that, are they good? Are they bad? I don't know, but they're frightening me. So if you're in that culture, then yeah, it's a part of the culture you know. If you're not in that culture, if I'm Korean American and you know, if you're a Korean Harry Potter fan, you want to see this representation of the culture that it came from, because that's true. That's what you would find if you walk into that culture, is this degree of embedded stereotype, this kind of prejudice that maybe goes back decades so that people don't even recognize it. It's an accurate picture of the culture that's being transmitted. Within the Harry Potter series, we actually have stories about what to do with books that might be suspicious.
Mm.
If you remember Harry and Hermione arguing over the Half-Blood Princess potions book.
Right.
Harry thinks, this is fine. I'm relating to the author, you know, to the kid who wrote the notes. In fact, don't take it away from me. Hermione is completely suspicious. What she reads is a completely different book. And of course, they're both right in different ways. You know, when she says, Sectum Sempra, I don't trust this guy, you know, and that turns out to be correct. But then when Hermione demands that the book reveal itself and its evil intentions, it's something like, it's just a textbook. It's dog-eared and disreputable looking. It's so prosaic. The book itself, don't be afraid of the book itself. It's about the meeting between the artist who created it and the audience member encountering it. That's where the meeting's going to be. Books are just books. And that happens, again, most notably with Tom Riddle's diary that mm-hmm. he wrote at the same age as Snape doing his potions book, where literally it's a different book depending on what the reader puts into it. Because Ron looks at it and Ron is not curious at all, and it's completely blank. Ginny pours her mm-hmm. ink and feelings into it, and it tells her all sorts of things that she needs to hear. Harry pours his ink and feelings into it, and the book changes. The book rewrites itself according to what it's picking up from Harry.
Mm.
So that when the book becomes the 16-year-old ghost of Tom Riddle, or, you know, soul fragment of Tom Riddle, and talks to Harry, he says, oh, I don't care about Slytherin's agenda anymore. Ever since Ginny Weasley told me about you, my goal has been to meet you, Harry Potter. The book has been rewritten because of what the reader put into it. Mm. But Ginny wasn't reading that. Harry was.
And so, Ginny, of course, got possessed by the book, right? There's mm-hmm. a way that the book did take her over because of that meeting of the two biographies that you're describing there, the young Tom yeah. Riddle to this young girl who's so vulnerable.
And only because she was putting her soul into it.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have done it without that. So is the book itself dangerous? Don't be afraid of the book. Don't be afraid of what Rowling put of herself in her 30s and 40s into a series that spoke so much. What matters is our relationship to the book. Harry reads what the diary of 16-year-old Tom Riddle has to say, knowing that he became this 70-year-old mass murdering dictator.
Mm-hmm.
So that informs what Harry sees, and it's also informed by Harry's fears of trying to reject Tom Riddle's suggestion that they're actually very similar. Look, we even look alike. And Harry's like, we do not look anything alike. And that, the fear, you know, yeah, the fear is equally in ourselves about who we are and in what we hunger for when we want to hear a story from somebody else.
So I'm really interested, Lori, you've done so much work with Snape, and you brought up, you know, we're talking about two biographies meeting in, you know, through a book, and the Half-Blood Prince potion book that is, you know, annotated by young Snape. And Harry is meeting Snape through this, you know, basically it is his art. Snape's art is potion making. And so he's meeting him this way without knowing that it's Snape. And I wonder if you think, you know, how does that relate to at the end of the series when Snape does his look at me and Harry is then able to see Snape and see Snape as Snape? Do you think that that earlier introduction to him as the Half-Blood Prince and the annotator of Potion Maker, did that have an influence on, you know, how he could meet the human being Snape, not the villain Snape, but the human being?
I think that's the question we're all asking ourselves, is how extreme can a human being be for us to still know, you know, they are human like me, we are alike. And this happens for Harry with James Potter, you know, that he has this extreme heroic legacy and also this extreme jerkiness.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
I like the way you put that.
This happens infinitely more with Snape, who carries around the guilt of having contributed to genocide and the second half of his life trying to make up for it while still being a pretty rotten person. You know, it's none of it's easy at all. So do we say that person's a monster, they're nothing like me, which gives a lot of fear to it? Or do we say, no, I understand still something about them, which is even more frightening because then, you know, do I have that in me? That's the question that Dumbledore asks Snape when he's asking Snape to kill him. He says, only you know if you have what it takes to do this and then go on. And Snape has to consult in himself. And at that point, which is why I love Snape so much, he has the greatness to think about it, to understand that question and say, yes, I do. But that's sort of what we readers have to ask of ourselves too, is do we have what it takes to accept all of the love and identification we had with this series at the same time that we're comprehending something happened to this individual person that we don't know, to turn all of her power against ourselves and our loved ones in a way that is terrifying? How big do we have to be to contain all of that? We can try to avoid that. We can try, for example, as many people have, to say, we're just never going to deal with Harry Potter again and lock it all up and, you know, put it away. Okay. We can pretend that this isn't happening and this is always going to be 2007 J.K. Rowling, who, if she has thoughts about trans people, has not seen fit to share them with the world yet. Neither of those things has very much weight. We can try. When I think about people who try either tactic, it reminds me of those spells that you can cast and then you have to keep casting them because they wear off.
So one of the things that Diderot talks about in this book, and again, it's called Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma. She talks about the kind of unforgivable flaw in a person's biography as a stain, the stain that taints the art itself, and that she thinks spreads not only forward in time from the time at which the transgression occurred, but it also flows backward into things before. And like you said, like, did she have these ideas in 2007? Are they new ideas? We don't know. And so it does influence the way that we read the books that she wrote before she said these things. And so I'm interested in, you know, what do you think, Lori, about this concept of the stain that taints the monstrous, you know, the art of so-called monstrous people. And, you know, do you think, like, I think we're all people who we are seeing the stain, right? But there are people who don't and don't really want to know. What would you say to that, Lori?
If that's where they're meeting the art, it is what it is. What I'm seeing from what kind of attitude and strategy we're supposed to have, that we should take toward this phenomenon, is not that we make up something that's logical and can be prescriptive, but just to take a survey. How is this being experienced? And yes, there definitely are people who are experiencing this as, I don't know, or I don't care. And there are people who experience this as, it hurts so much, I can't ever think about it again. And there is a volatile segment of people who feel particularly betrayed because they loved the stories and now they didn't expect this kind of animosity. And they say, if I meet people who don't also avoid Harry Potter, I'm going to feel endangered by them. So, you know, then it becomes a question of a relationship between one reader and another, not so much to do with the source material. And these are all important. They're all happening.
Right.
And as Dieterer says, no one wants the stain to happen. It just does. We don't decide that coloration is going to happen. We don't get to make decisions about the stain. It's already too late. Mm-hmm. It touches everything. Our understanding of the work has taken on a new color, whether we like it or not. Indelibility is not voluntary. When someone says we ought to separate the art from the artist, they're saying, remove the stain. Let the work be unstained. But that's not how stains work. So what I'm seeing here is the responsibility on us, I think, is to take a survey of how people are experiencing this and to know, you know, these are all things, these are all ways that people relate to art and literature. And I've been actually pretty grateful to be living through this in real time because I've studied other eras with other authors where they were enormously popular and then something happened to complicate people's relationship. Here we are going through it in real time. It feels terrible. And no, not everybody responds to it the same way. But I think the image of Harry having gnawing, terrible fears about Dumbledore, the Dumbledore of 1898, you know, after Dumbledore's death, I think that's a really relatable situation to the fear we have now of, what did we trust? What did I just trust? Mm-hmm. Was something wrong with me? Can I go forward now? I believed this, but for various reasons, Dumbledore because he's dead and J.K. Rowling because, as far as we're concerned day to day, she's not real. Like, we can't talk to her.
Yes.
You know, so it's not like we can go ask her.
All right.
What do I do with this belief that I have? How am I supposed to test out something that was constitutive to me, to my selfhood? Okay, it can be done. It takes a long time. It's very painful. And it's, you know, scary.
Yeah. And I what I like also, you had said this too, is, you know, the emphasis is on feelings. And she denies that there's ever one answer. And she really has us think about it for ourselves, that it is a subjectivity, right? It's going to be different for different people. Which I appreciate. We had said that in the Potterversity book, there was a question about, you know, how do we deal with this in the introduction to acknowledge it? And I think where we ended up is, like, there are lots of reactions that people have. And we're open to hearing all of the reactions and thinking about, you know, then what is my reaction? And that, in a sense, that's all you have the ability to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Lori, I'm really interested that you have this podcast where you are deliberately reading the Harry Potter series chapter by chapter. And it's called Harry Potter After 2020. It's basically a rereading based on, right? Like, now we know the stain, right? How do we interpret it? And I'm really curious about whether you, in that process of going through the books, is the stain, is it influencing the way that you read the books or watch the movies or any of that? And where do you see that?
Well, when I decided to call the podcast Harry Potter After 2020, it's not only about the transphobia. It's also because 2020 was this radical break in mm-hmm. how humans saw the world because of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think Turfpocalypse, which is my phrase for the phenomenon of what happens to Harry Potter fandom once J.K. Rowling switches her platform to transphobia. I think of Turfpocalypse as a pandemic casualty also because some of that pressure cooker thought that erupted into her gender manifesto came from lockdown and the frustrations of lockdown. And by that point, in mid-year 2020, there was so much death, so much isolation because of the pandemic and also Black Lives Matter, the protest yeah. movements about police violence that's racially motivated, showing that, objectively speaking, it's harder to live as a minority. Those things had created such a sense of guilt and helplessness, I think, that there was, in fact, a documented shift toward what a relief it would be to scapegoat somebody else. You know, to say, you might be trans, but I'm not cis, I'm normal. You might be a person of color, but I'm white, I'm normal. You know, that it was part of the discourse, which we saw, if my favorite thing, if you recall Katie Leung, the actress who played Cho Chang, her Twitter response to J.K. Rowling's gender manifesto was to post a thread of links to Black trans fundraisers. She, without naming it, she put her finger on it. So there was that. And also 2020 is the end of a four-year cycle between U.S. electoral politics and Brexit, when the world, the Anglophone world that you and I are in as Harry Potter fans, took this huge shift toward fascism, which affected the way that people related to the Harry Potter allegory of fascism. Because I know that people who, as children, had read Harry Potter and Death Eaters and Voldemort as an allegory about good and evil were revisiting it as documentary. Like,
yeah,
at the beginning of the Trump presidency, when he wanted to register every American Muslim, the way that was exactly the same as the Muggle-born Registration Commission, it could not have been more point for point exactly the same. Mm-hmm. This is not allegory. This changes how readers relate to a piece of literature. And what happened there was that a generation that knew this story collectively together could refer to it to help each other make sense of what was happening to us in real time.
Right. You know, Lori, I've told this story before. Listeners are probably tired of me saying it, but at some point, this was before 2020, but in support in the previous four-year cycle, my son, who was a Harry Potter reader, he was very distressed. And he just, the way he expressed it to me was, I feel like we're living in Harry Potter book five.
Yeah.
And he struggles to put words to his feelings. And yet that series of stories had given him a way to encapsulate, this is what I see happening. And my response to that was, Dumbledore's army still recruiting. Right. And so, like, you know, we were able to have a little conversation about it. But I also think what you're talking about here, do you remember that Timothy Snyder was the keynote speaker at Harry Potter Academic Conference? And talked about, he is this Eastern European historian, a very serious historian. And he talked about how J.K. Rowling, who's read all this history, you know, of not just Eastern Europe, but, you know, fascism and the pre-World War II era, that, you know, he's like, this is very similar. Like, this is mm-hmm. the blueprint for totalitarian takeover. And so I think all of that stew that you're talking about, absolutely, I can see that coming together.
This encounter I had that I just won't forget. Alex Gino is an author of the book was originally published as George. It's now published as Melissa. It's about a fourth grade kid who's transgender. And I met Alex Gino, who asked me, so what are you working on? And I looked straight at them and I said, I was asked in 2021 to revise a book about Harry Potter that I wrote in 2016. And they looked at me and I looked at them and they went, oh. And I said, I revised the Snape book to be in a post-apocalyptic landscape where everything that Rowling wrote about gender is going to encounter a nervous reader. Was this all there? Did I just miss it? Or, you know, there were people who will say, yes, it was all there. And then there are other people saying, well, I read it and it didn't register with me. In my defense, I was 8. You know, I rewrote the section on Lupin coaching Neville to put his Boggart as Snape into his grandmother's clothing. I rewrote that whole section.
I remember that presentation at the Harry Potter Academic Conference. That was revelatory, Lori.
Yeah.
Very well done. And you were very careful about your reading on that. It wasn't some glib thing, right? You were very careful about it. And that was fascinating.
And the thing is, everything that I saw in it after Turfpocalypse was there before, too. But I had not been centering a trans viewpoint before. And that was a marker of my privilege because I'm cis and I didn't feel like I had to until the question got called. And then I thought, you know, if you center a viewpoint that is ratified by, I had a panel of trans sensitivity readers that I recruited and paid and got a wide variety of responses from. It's a post-lapsarian, that word comes up for me over and over and over again about Turfpocalypse. There's a longing, understandable and impossible longing, I think, that I hear from a lot of readers of, oh, I wish we could go back to being able to think of Harry Potter before the fall, before we found out that Rowling is going to be against medical care for trans teenagers. Well, we can't. It's the post-lapsarian world. But if you cut off your access to something that was an important story to you in your childhood, you cut off an enormous wealth of your own memories and your own development. And we've seen that. We've seen this giant rupture in people's consciousness from before and after 2020 for various reasons. When you go back to it, when you recover who you were then, it's really emotional. And actually, nobody cares if you do that, except it's important to you. But you're not being more virtuous. You're not fighting the good fight by cutting off your own memories. And when people are saying that they feel personally betrayed by Rowling, and it's like they want to hurt her back by withholding their support, she doesn't feel it. If you cut off your own memories, if you don't access who you were at the time that you read and bonded with these books, she won't feel it, but you will feel it. And I thought for that reason, it's worthwhile for me to go back into these stories chapter by chapter to look at it from this post-lapsarian lens to see, do we have to be afraid of the stories or not? And so far I've found, no, I don't. The stories, the books, I'm not afraid of them.
I love that. I also think that the books themselves are a morality tale against letting fear control you, right? So it's all about really you controlling the fear and not letting fear drag you into bad positions, which I think is what has actually happened with J.K. Rowling. I believe it's her fear talking whenever she whenever she brings up these things. That's what it sounds like to me. But also, I was struck by how much this relates to what Claire Dederer says in her book, because she says, she's like, who am I to tell somebody they can't like the R. Kelly song they played at their wedding? Right. And that in a sense, these things are important. And they, like you say, they play an important role in your own past, in like your identity formation. You said constitutive was a word you used before. And they are constitutive. And so if you can find a way to keep some part of what they brought to you, maybe it is worth staying in conversation with those texts.
Yeah, at that point, it becomes about a relationship between one reader and another. You know, when you have people say, can I trust a random person that I pass on the street who's wearing a Harry Potter t-shirt, or are they going to turn out to be transphobic? You know, these fears are real. It's way too privileged to pretend that death of the author is possible when your own actual survival is on the line here.
Yes.
How we deal with this is more about us living with each other than it is about us with a text and an author that we don't know.
That's so important, Lori. It's a revelation that's interesting and that we should all be thinking about. Well, Lori, how do you think you will go forward in the Harry Potter community, given what we know about the artist behind the series?
What I've been doing is looking at who's left in the Harry Potter fan community. People like us, people who could not cut Harry Potter out of our lives, and in this fallen world, accept, okay, we're still engaging with it in some way. It's a very trans fandom. And as Alex Gino said to me, it's a very trans story. The allegory itself,
yes,
about being who you truly are on the inside, regardless of the artist and what she's become, the story is the story. You respond to the story. Whether I decide to boycott Warner Brothers and Harry Potter and JKR merch or not, whether I decide that I'm going to withhold my $20, you know, as a matter of principle, that's, you know, one of the strategies that people advocate, and it has its place, but they don't feel it. And this is something that was not apparent to us in 2020, because there was a huge and wildly successful cancellation effort to make our reaction known against the transphobia, and it made a difference. But honestly, the Harry Potter phenomenon globally is too huge. They don't feel it if you decide not to buy a book or not. Who feels it is if you donate that same amount of money to fighting transphobia. Because J.K. Rowling does not care what I think about her. What I care about is the real issue is fighting transphobia, protecting my loved ones. And the same $20 that means nothing to Warner Brothers makes a huge difference to a tiny organization that's grassroots and volunteer funded, that is fighting ballot initiatives. That's, you know, the only people, sometimes this isn't true, but it feels sometimes like the only people out there fighting for us are the ones fighting all of this political change that's trying to enshrine transphobia into the government. It just goes straight to activism for me, because that's what's upsetting to me. And meanwhile, the communities that I see that have formed around Harry Potter fandom, even though there is this lack of trust in the source material because of the author, I've tried to get together with other fans without the source material involved. Like, what if I just got together with people I like? It doesn't, even when the center has a hole in it, even when it's empty, you do need that, because there was something in the story that we all responded to. That's what connects us. That's why we want to be with this connection, with this collection of other people. The phenomenon of Harry Potter fans or ex-fans who are gathering around certain kinds of values to fight transphobia, to fight various human rights violations, to make a more equitable and inclusive world. just in sheer numbers, this story, the Harry Potter books, were so well written and so powerful that they appealed to such a huge population. This population can go on and be effective even now. And that's, and the brokenness of being a Harry Potter fan is so emblematic of just how a lot of things feel post-pandemic, post-fascist turn. I think it's a really fruitful place to be, and it's certainly where people that I want to be around can gather still and do still gather. So I'm going forward finding other people who have the same set of feelings and responses and hurt that I do, and the same determination to do something about it.
Lori, I love that.
A great point. Yeah. Yeah.
I feel that too, in the sense that, yeah, I am going forward with it, and I'm trying to go forward with it maybe in a more mature, bittersweet kind of mm-hmm. way.
More knowing.
Right. Less idealistic maybe, but like you said, the brokenness of the community feels like it's emblematic of our very moment. Well, gosh, thank you so much, Lori Kim, for joining us for what has been, I think, a really fascinating and, I think, honest and vulnerable conversation. Thank you, Lori.
Thanks for having me so much.
Well, today we are going to close with two quotes. And I thought, since we have been talking a lot about the book Monsters, A Fan's Dilemma, I would close with a quote that she sort of comes around to, and I think this is where we've ended up as well, you know, that a lot of the way that we respond to art and to each other has to do with love and what we love. And that is sometimes very complicated. And so Claire Dederer says this at the end. She says, that is, love is not reliant on judgment, but on a decision to set judgment aside. Love is anarchy. Love is chaos. We don't love the deserving. We love the flawed and imperfect human beings in an emotional logic that belongs to an entirely different weather system than the chilly climate of reason. And then to bring us back to the wizarding world, I thought I would end with a quote from the film Fantastic Beasts: Crimes of Grindelwald, where Leta Lestrange says, "You're too good, Newt. You never met a monster you couldn't love."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.